So it's our full moon Uposatha day, full moon of August, and we're 2 weeks into the Vasa period, the rainy season. Rainy season in India, of course, but it's a traditional period of retreat time, stemming from the time of the Buddha. And one of the things we do here during the Vasa period is have each of the members of the community take a couple weeks of solitude, so that this next 2 weeks I get the opportunity to be in solitude and I always look forward to that time. And I find that period of stepping back and having a period of retreat is a good way to kind of renew or review or reinvigorate the practice. Stepping back from, correspondence, duties, engagement in regular ways. We don't really do complete and utter solitude, but stepping back is really fruitful, and that's something that whether as a monastic or as a layperson, it's good to take periods of time to step back, and on a certain level, even for the lay people coming to the monastery, is an opportunity to step back from the ordinary, regular engagement in the world with family duties, whatnot. However it works for one, it's helpful to step back and have periods of retreat time. So it's just the nature of the mind. We tend to get used to everything, and things become ordinary, or you just become inured to whatever experience one is doing. And that happens whether one's in a monastery or in the world. It's what the mind does. Of course, it's not a good part of the mind, but we just have to be aware of that. And be finding ways to skillfully reflect and investigate, so that we're able to bring a freshness to the mind. And certainly, I've always found that stepping back and doing periods of retreat are a good way of reinvigorating practice. So it's having that opportunity. But whether we're, say, whether we're in retreat or not in retreat, there's, you know, what we contemplate or what we practice with is really not, it's really not all that different. There's an idiom that comes up in the suttas over and over again, sort of the lawfulness of the Dhamma. I think in Pali, Dhamma Niyamata. So yeah, it's just this lawfulness of the Dhamma, the regularity of the Dhamma. The Dhamma works in these ways. You do certain things and they bring certain results. The mind, the heart responds to certain things. It's just so much more satisfying to be, you know, to be happy, to be peaceful, to be clear, to be steady. And it's just is a, that's the way it works. Even though sometimes, say, distraction and excitement can be compelling, yeah, it ends up not being very satisfying. So the inclination to cultivating that which is peaceful, that which is clear, steady, solid, it's really important, because it's just the way the universe is configured. This lawfulness of the Dhamma. One of the places that idiom comes up is it's toward the end of the Buddha's life, because it's in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Sariputta makes this sort of very bold statement that he just has such just tremendous faith in the Buddha that there's never been in the past and won't be in the future, never is in the present. You know, anybody is fully awakened, fully enlightened, fully realized as the Buddha. And the Buddha, in his kind of circumspect manner, very kind of wry observation, says, "Oh, Sariputta, do you actually know the virtue, the meditation, the awakening, realization of the Buddhas of the past? And do you actually know these qualities, Buddhas in the future, or do you even know those qualities of the Buddha in this present?" And of course, Sariputta says, "Well, no, not really." but he said, "I understand the lawfulness of the Dhamma, that if one is going to experience this, that kind of virtue, that purity, that peace, that wisdom, that those realizations, it has to be through the relinquishing of the five hindrances, the establishing of the four foundations of mindfulness, cultivation of the seven factors of awakening. That's it has to be in that doorway That is the way to the Dhamma. There is this lawfulness of the Dhamma. And Sariputta gives an image of that in the same way that say an ancient city would have a city wall going around it, and if it had the head watchman would go around that those walls, those ramparts, and be check them, recheck them, and know that there's only this one gate coming in, and it in the same way that that's if somebody comes and you let in the good people, you turn away the enemies, and in the same way that if someone is going to enter this Dhamma, these realizations, these qualities of the Tathagata, this awakening, this is the way, that's the only way in. So it's a very beautiful image, and then that theme there, there is this lawfulness of the Dhamma. The Dhamma functions in this way, the component pieces of realizing the Dhamma, realizing the fruits of it, realizing the experience of the Dhamma, the relinquishing of the five hindrances, establishing the four foundations of mindfulness, cultivating the seven factors of awakening. So these are, you know, on a certain level, it's just the, it's just almost like Buddhism 101. But it, you realize it has major implications, and to lay those foundations, be attentive and be assiduous in the cultivation of these fundamentals of the practice, so that and that's a, you know, it's kind of a, it is an element of right view as well, in that. You know, part of the kind of delusions that we get caught up in, is that somehow if I, just heard the right teaching, or just met the right teacher, or I just was in the right absolute right conditions, then somehow I'd realize Dhamma, and it isn't as if those don't have a place, but this lawfulness of the Dhamma is such that we have to have these fundamentals of the practice and the implementation, the living of the Dhamma, in order to truly realize, and that. So that's this, you know, paying attention to right view. It's like, remember Ajahn Chah talking about practice, and of course he encouraged practice a lot. Eat little, sleep little, speak little, practice a lot. And this is like a mantra that you kept, that I heard as a young monk. Put a lot of effort into practice, but he'd always be couched in or held by these aspects of right view, and that you put the effort in to the practice, but you also pay attention to the quality of uncertainty, of changefulness, of anicca, uncertainty, unsure, impermanent. Things are subject to change. And that being able to cut through, because everything, when we experience something that we like, it seems so real. And we invest our kind of emotion and perspective. I just got there what I like, then everything's going to be fine. These things that I experience that I dislike, if I just got rid of that, then everything would be fine. The views and opinions that we hold of what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong. We don't look at it through, we look at it through that lens of that side of experience, but we don't frame it in the frame of change, of changefulness, of unsure. Ajahn Chah used to, in Thai, I would say, "Mai na," not a sure thing. But as long as we don't really fully accept that uncertainty, then we're stuck in wrong view. And it isn't just repeating it over and over again, it's right, really bringing it into the heart and realizing, I can't invest in this is not really worth believing in. It's not worth staking my claim to this. So and of course, then when we think of anicca or not unsure, changefulness, it's part of what the Buddha points to as universal characteristics. The anicca, dukkha, anatta, the impermanence, dukkha, the unsatisfactory, the stressful suffering. And the aspect of not self. This is not what I truly am. This is not my essence. This aspect of experiences. And that lawfulness of the Dhamma says it's going to change. And so this right view. So one other thing, I was called right view. There's this Majjhima 117, the discourse on the Great 40, where right view leads, and it circles around right effort and right mindfulness, and those aspects of these three circle around each other, and right view is but right view comes first, and of course it gets built and layered and clarified. But that right view, right effort, right mindfulness, are like just making sure we're circling around us. So in practice, keeping the we don't need to do anything really special. We don't need to be doing anything extreme, but coming back to that fundamental right view, right effort, right mindfulness. And it's how we keep kind of nourishing or nurturing the practice, and keep returning to that training. And again, it's not. It's not anything abstruse or esoteric. Relinquishing the five hindrances, establishing oneself in the four foundations of mindfulness, of cultivation of seven factors of awakening. And especially as we say, taking on periods of meditation, although really at any point in time of our life, five hindrances is paying attention to those hindrances, obstacles, obstructions, sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, kind of worry and remorse, skeptical doubt, or wavering of mind. Recognizing that, and those are just they're very ordinary qualities of mind, but what the Buddha says is they obscure mindfulness and weaken discernment, weaken our wisdom. And as long as we keep buying into supporting being entangled in the hindrances, then the mind is not going to be a suitable vessel for realization. It's not going to be a suitable tool to get the job done. And so paying attention to relinquishing purification, or at least the bringing into abeyance, at least temporarily, get a bit of a break from these hindrances. And Buddha, one of the images that the Buddha gives is of gold, and that gold, when it is mixed with other metals, then it's just not pliable, it's not malleable, it's not luminous. And there's a beautiful imagery that the Buddha uses in it. And what are the impurities that make the mind not pliable, not malleable, not luminous. And just that, and Buddha said, no. Copper, tin, lead, iron, silver. As these are five different metals, common metals, and they get mixed up with the gold, and then the gold is not easily worked. It doesn't make ornaments as beautifully And so in the same way that the mind is sense, desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, remorse and worry, skeptical doubt, wavering, the mind is not, it's not pliable, it's not soft. It's rigid, it's not, and so that we, you want a kind of a softness of mind. Malleable, you want to, it wants to be workable, it wants to be adaptable and luminous. And you, the mind, it really does have a quality of brightness when we are mindful and have a steady quality within. We're not entangled in you know, various moods going up and down and bouncing here and there with our views and opinions and our kind of the mind going out into the world seeking distraction or reacting out of fear. There's a luminosity, a brightness that is quite. And it's not just capable, it's more what its nature is. And that's sort of the lawfulness of the Dhamma, is that that's what the mind is like when one is able to see clearly and direct one's efforts and attention in an appropriate way. So these five hindrances, they... And cultivation, then establishing oneself in the four foundations of mindfulness. It's not, no, again, we're not looking far away to where the Dhamma is. It's the four foundations of body, feeling, mind, mental phenomena. It's not far away. It's right here. Turning attention or returning attention to these fundamentals of experience, but being clear, seeing the body as the body, seeing the body in and of itself. I mean, those are different ways that the idiom is used, because again, body, feeling, mind, mental phenomena. You know, we read so much into it of personality or identity, projection of the world, and it's a just body as body, feeling as feeling. Just in and of itself, it's not, how do we bring it back down to its fundamental core? Seven factors of awakening, again, it's not nothing that we're not familiar with, but it's that cultivation of mindfulness. Like we chanted Parittas this evening, and one of the chants is the Bojanga chant, the chant on the seven factors of awakening, because it was used for helping. I mean, the Buddha used it himself to teach others that, and just reflecting on these seven factors of awakening, and it's exhilarating enough when once becomes clear that illness would fade away when one returns to one's faculties. So the first quality, mindfulness, second quality, investigation of Dhammas, reflection on Dhamma, reflection on the phenomena. The quality of effort. There isn't, you know, the effort comes up in all of the, pretty much all of the Buddha's lists of essential spiritual qualities. So that having the, putting forth the effort, putting forth energy, but of course it being balanced, circling with right view, right mindfulness, right effort. Beti, joy, exhilaration, that these are qualities that the mind becomes energized, but it also it doesn't become frazzled it's part and parcel. Again, this lawfulness of the Dhamma. It says it's the way the Dhamma works. If you're meditating and putting forth effort and getting more and more depressed, and you've got to step back and reflect. What am I missing? What's happening here? What am I getting obsessed with? What am I? How am I missing that relinquishing of the hindrances? Is it? Because sometimes we can get concentrated, but the Buddha said, yeah, there's wrong concentration as well. You can get concentrated in a way that you just get obsessed with yourself, and it's not beautiful, the results. Basati is this tranquility, ease. But it's going to start to get settled, and then moves into samadhi, composure, settledness of mind, equanimity. And equanimity is not indifference. And equanimity is kind of an even. It's equanimity, but it's in the sense of being even, balanced, not shaken. So these seven factors of awakening, we cultivate them, they need to be developed. But it's in conjunction with these other aspects of the path, that relinquishing of the hindrances, continuity of mindfulness and awareness of a full knowing. So many of the forest teachers of the Northeast, the Buddho being a practice, and sort of returning to the one who knows, is coming back to this quality of awareness and mindfulness. It's our nourishing root for our practice. So these are some reflections on the Dhamma tonight, and just going over that theme or that phrase, the lawfulness of the Dhamma, and to delight in that reality, that truth, the Dhamma is there to kind of support us. The practice is here to give us the opportunity to experience the fruits of it. To offer that reflection to you.